This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. President Bush says the time has come to reform Social Security. The Bush administration argues that Social Security is heading toward financial collapse. In his State of the Union address, the president called for partially privatizing the nation's nearly 70-year-old retirement system. But many in Congress and in the general public don't yet seem convinced that it's the right way to go, to let individuals invest some of what the government now withholds. This hour, we're going to step outside the pro-con argument here in the United States. We'll take a look at two other countries that have implemented privatization, England and Chile, to see how those systems have fared. Later in the program, as Cuba begins an island-wide ban on smoking in public places, a look at whether smoking bans really help people kick their habit. But for now, Social Security abroad. If you have questions about how other countries handle retirement, give us a call. Or if you've lived in another country, tell us how retirement plans work there. Or maybe you have a relative who has shared an experience with you that you can share with us. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. To get us started, we turn to Jonathan Gruber, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-editor of the book Social Security Programs and Retirement Around the World. He joins us from a studio at Berkland Productions in Watertown, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's start by just making it clear what we do have in this country. And right now, our Social Security program is something that's called a traditional pay-as-you-go program. Remind us of how that works.
Well, basically, the way it works is currently workers pay money out of their paycheck. You might see something on your paycheck called a FICA contribution. That's the money you're paying to help pay for the Social Security system. That money goes into a trust fund, and from that trust fund is paid out to today's retirees. So it's called pay-as-you-go because we pay now, the money that young workers pay now goes to today's retirees.
So it's not like, I mean, I'm probably alone in this. Maybe everybody knew better than me, but I thought that this was like a little pot of money that they put aside for you, but that's not at all the case.
No, that's not the case.
This FICA money that we're paying every paycheck.
Exactly. Traditionally, it wasn't the case at all. Traditionally, it went in and went right out. Since 1983, we've built up what's called the Social Security Trust Fund, where we do pay in more than is going out. So it's building up a little bit, but it doesn't have our name on it. It's not our own account. What's happening is we're paying into a common fund. It's being paid out to today's retirees, and some of it's being saved for future retirees.
Right. And even the trust fund, I want to clear up a couple of these things because I think there's like these words that get thrown around and people maybe don't understand. But the trust fund isn't like there's some vault someplace with bags and bags of dollars sitting in it ready to be taken out. The trust fund is also just a construct. I mean, people have borrowed against that in some cases.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, and that's a really important issue. You remember Al Gore's ill-fated choice of the lockbox term during the 2000 presidential debates. While his word choice may have been unfortunate, his point was a very important one, which is in principle we have this trust fund that's being set aside to pay for retirement. But in practice, in fact, politicians aren't treating it with the respect it deserves. They're spending it. So when President Bush announces a budget with a deficit of, say, $500 billion, what's not accounted for the fact is that, in fact, there's a non-Social Security deficit of, say, $750 billion and a Social Security surplus of about $250 billion. And that surplus is really what we're supposed to be saving. The question is the government really saving that or not?
Got it. Now, many countries in Europe also use this kind of pay-as-you-go system. Isn't that right?
Yes. This is the traditional way that almost all nations have done their Social Security.
And have they worked? I mean, ours has worked for 70 years, and I guess it will continue to work for some period of time, but have they worked in general?
Well, you have to define worked. Basically, virtually all nations started this system by essentially giving money away free to the first generation. So in the U.S., the first woman to collect Social Security was Ida Mae Fuller. She paid $22 of taxes and got $100,000 of benefits before she died. We are, in some sense, still paying for Ida Mae Fuller. We are paying more in taxes then we're going to get in benefits because we gave money away free to the first generation, and that was the idea. These are people who'd suffered in the Great Depression. We want to help them out. That's been true in virtually every nation. The first generation made out very well because the government intended to help them out. As a result, later generations have to make up for that. It's something often called the legacy debt. And in many countries, as in the U.S., the system is not in balance because we have this legacy debt. We have money that we paid out to early generations that we still need to make up. And that's true virtually all around the world. The magnitude of this debt differs. In some countries, it's really crushing. In the U.S., I think most people would say it's not that large. But the basic debt issue exists in any pay-as-you-go system, or almost all of them.
We're talking about Social Security. We're starting our tour in this country, but pretty soon we'll be traveling abroad to hear how other countries do it. In particular, we'll be looking into the question of countries that have tried schemes somewhat like the president has is proposing of creating private accounts or privatizing or personal accounts or whichever kind of language you want to use. But anyway, a system that allows people to invest in stocks or other, well, certain stocks anyway, that that are not the ones not just hand the money to the government and wait to hand it back. We'd like to take your calls. We're on 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us an email with your questions or comments, TOTN@npr.org. Isn't there a problem with these pay-as-you-go systems? It has a little bit of a quality of a pyramid scheme where, you know, if you get in at the base, you're in good shape, but you could be troubled down the line.
That's exactly right. The first generation did very well. Later generations have to pay for that. But the issue, I think the key issues we talk about privatization is that is a separate issue from privatization. There's really two issues we face in the U.S. today. One is over the next 75 years, we have a shortfall in the money we need to pay the benefits we've promised. And that is an issue, and that needs to be addressed in one of two ways. Either taxes have to be raised or benefits have to be cut. That math is unavoidable. There's a second issue about whether we want to get out from this system and try something new in privatization, but that's a completely different issue. The first fundamental issue is how are we going to make up for the shortfall that we face, that, by the way, is a lot smaller in the U.S. than it is in most, say, European nations.
Okay. And is Social Security supposed to be, you know, are people supposed to be able, I mean, to live on what they are getting in Social Security? You mentioned the first recipient coming away with $100,000, but even in its most generous, Social Security is got to be not quite, you can't live the high life on that much money.
No, you can't. I mean, about a large share of Americans, of elderly Americans, around a quarter to a third, live only on their Social Security benefits. And for the typical elderly family, Social Security provides more than half their family income. So there are many families living on this. It replaces typically about 40% of what workers earned before they retired. So, you know, it all depends on how you want your living standards to be. It's certainly true that you can't maintain your pre-retirement living standards just on your Social Security. You need to supplement that with some other form of savings.
So how is a system that would have private accounts differ from the kind that we have right now?
Well, basically, if you think about a pure privatized system, say Chile, who we'll talk about later as the best example, the way it would work is instead of being pay-as-you-go, where I save now to pay the retiree benefits of, say, my grandparents, it would be that my savings would go into a bank account with my name on it or into some kind of account with my name on it. That would be saved in my name, and when I retired, I would get that money back. So it's more like, as you were saying earlier, Joe, your understanding of how the system worked, it's more like a real sort of savings system rather than a system of transfer from young to the elderly.
Mm-hmm. And is it a question of just how – I mean, is it a question of where you put that money or is it a question of how you categorize it? I mean, could the government, without using the stock market at all, could they create a system of private accounts or personal accounts?
Yeah. Sweden actually has something called notional defined contribution or private accounts where basically it's like Social Security but your name's on it. And so in some sense, if you want your name on it, that's a different thing. What privatization is really about is the individual abilities to control the ability of individuals to control their investments, be able to take that money instead of paying it a check to the government and then being paid out to the elderly, to actually take it and invest it in some mix of investments of stocks and bonds as they like and to then have control over that money and receive it when they retire.
I see. So what are, I mean, is I guess there's a whole range of possible options, but maybe you can explain first. Maybe we should just start by saying, why is the president saying we have to deal with this now?
Well, the president is, quite frankly, pulling a bit of a bait and switch on us on this one. I think it's important to recognize there's two issues going on. As I said, there's the solvency issue, which is that we have a shortfall between what we've promised and what we'll collect. By the way, this won't be an issue for 40 more years, but in 40 more years, this trust fund we've been building up will run out of money, and we'll have to find some other source of money to pay the benefits. That's an unavoidable fact, and we have to deal with that either by raising tax or cutting benefits. Privatization is a totally separate issue, and we can talk about why the president may or may not want to do that, but that is a separate issue. And unfortunately, the president and other politicians are tying these together and saying because we're going to run out of money, we need to privatize. What's important to recognize is one has nothing to do with the other.
Right, but
It's just sort of
these are
an
just schemes
opportunistic.
of. I mean, what he's proposing is a way of dealing with the problem. I mean, you could always just say we have to pay more in, or
No,
or reduce
let's be clear.
benefits.
The way he's proposing does not deal with the problem. Dealing with the problem, once again, we have promised more in benefits than we'll collect in taxes. The only way to deal with the problem is either collect more in taxes or pay less in
Okay,
benefits.
I see.
What he's proposing, because let's put it this way. Right now, I'm paying checks to support my grandparents. If I set up a private account, that means my check goes to my account. Well, who supports my grandparents? Someone else has to. That involves an enormous amount of borrowing. So what President Bush's scheme would essentially involve, or privatization would involve, would be instead of my check going to my grandparents, it would be my check going to my account and the government borrowing to pay my grandparents. That doesn't solve the government's problem at all. It just substitutes the government borrowing for my paying to them directly.
Okay, so we're going to have a lot of time to talk about this. Anyway, we have to take a short break. When we return, experts from Great Britain and Chile tell us how privatization of Social Security worked in their countries. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking with economist Jonathan Gruber about retirement around the world, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255, or our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call now from Karen in Raleigh, North Carolina. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, the European countries, did they have to transition like we're going to have to do if this happens, going to private accounts? And if they did, what age did they do the change? I'm 50 years old, and what I'm hearing is that if you're 55 or older, then nothing's going to change for you. So I was wondering how they handled that transition because I'm obviously concerned about it.
Yeah, with reason. Okay, good question, Karen. Jonathan Gruber, perhaps you can tackle that.
Karen, that is a good question. And the important thing to recognize is most European countries haven't privatized, haven't dealt with this shortfall. When countries have privatized, Chile being the best example, typically what they've done is at some age said, sorry, you're still in the old system. You don't get to take advantage of this. And I think, Karen, unfortunately, you'd probably be in that group. And then the question is at younger ages what they do. And what Chile did, for example, is give people a choice. Do you want to come into this new privatized system? And essentially take your chances investing your own money, or do you want to stay in the old system where the government invested for you? So really the issue is sort of twofold. At what age do we allow people to come into the system, and then are we going to do it through giving them a choice or not?
Another question I have is the private accounts to invest it is with what's been going on in the stock market and stuff like that, it's a little disconcerting for a lot of us that really don't know the stock market that well. And if the president feels so confident about this, what do they do with the money that's sitting there now? Why can't they take that and invest it, a bigger amount invested as a bigger return, right?
Karen,
yeah.
That is a really very good point. And there's two points that you're making. The first is the fundamental reason we have Social Security in this nation is that we don't think people are smart enough to save for their own retirement. Privatization says we're going to take those very people who we don't trust to save for their own retirement and trust them to make these complicated investment decisions. It's sort of a contradiction, I think, is what you're pointing out. It is very hard to decide how to invest your money, and that's a difficult issue. The other issue you're raising is, if we're really worried about efficient investments, why don't we just take the trust fund, which is now several hundred billion dollars, and put it in the stock market? And that is a really good question. Many individuals have strongly advocated that, said that's the way we can get the benefits of stock investment. Others, such as Alan Greenspan, worries that if the government's investing so much in the stock market, there'll be an incentive to interfere with the free operation of capital markets, and they're worried that might happen. The big question is, can the government set up a Federal Reserve-like institution to protect itself from interfering in capital markets if it invests the money in them?
Okay. Well, Karen, thanks very much for that call. To give us another perspective on the debate about Social Security here in the United States, we're going to focus on two countries that have introduced the option of privatized retirement programs. First, we'll look at Britain. Joining us now is Roz Altman, a critic of the UK's current system and a governor at the London School of Economics. She joins us by phone from her home in London. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. So, as I understand, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher introduced private accounts to the nation's retirement program in 1979. Can you tell us more about that plan?
Yeah, I mean, we started with privatization of our social security system about 25 years ago. And it's the initial privatization was that individuals could take some of their social security rights, and instead of building them up in the state system, they could build them up in a company pension. So if your company offered you a good pension scheme, you could, instead of paying your Social Security taxes to the government, actually put some of that money into a pension plan instead. And then about 10 years later, Mrs. Thatcher decided that she wanted everybody to be able to accrue money and privatize their pension rights too. So she allowed people to have privatization in personal pensions, not just in company pensions. So that's a bit like the 401k plans that you have.
Right.
And at that point, you could take the Social Security taxes that you would otherwise have had to pay, and they would be put into a personal pension plan for you. So everybody had the opportunity to build up a private pension, except for those who were self-employed. It's never really applied so much there because they don't accrue earnings-related pensions in the state scheme at all.
I got it. So how did the plan work?
Well,
or how is it working? I guess it's not. It's
yeah,
still in place.
I mean, here we are 25 years on, and the sad fact seems to be that it hasn't really worked out as well as one would have hoped. Part of the reason, of course, is that the stock market has had a pretty rough time. And until the year 2000 or so, it looked as if it wasn't going too badly. But even apart from that, the level of charges that financial services companies were levying on these privatized pension plans were high and detracted from the investment returns. And in fact, most people would estimate that the level of charges that has been quite common in the UK, certainly, has probably taken away over 30%, possibly even 50% of your capital over the long-term period.
As high as that. I guess I have a hard time understanding how you know, the charges could build up to such a large amount. I mean, even if it was only a few pennies on the dollar, I would have thought that the amount that the charges for operating the accounts would be a lot smaller. And certainly there's always the argument that private companies do it more efficiently than the government, so they have lower costs.
Well, our experience certainly is that because you don't have any of these economies of scale, which you would have if, for example, you invested the Social Security Trust Fund in the stock market instead, the charges for administration of these plans alone are very high. You know, each plan has to be set up as a pension plan. and that costs money. They all have agreements. They have to comply with certain rules. There's all sorts of regulations. And, you know, for people who are putting in relatively small sums of money each month, you still have fixed costs of administering all that.
So
you had upfront fees for selling the plans to people. You know, advisors would get initial commissions, which often meant that the first 3 to 5 years of your pension savings, very little actually went into the investment, and most of it went to the advisor.
Right, right.
And on top of that, you had annual charges, which were something around 2% sometimes. And then, of course, you had all sorts of penalties applied. Now, the government decided that that was really not working in the consumer's interests. So they've tried to put limits on the charges, charging caps. Right. And it started at 1%, and that hasn't worked. It's now gone up to 1.5% per annum as the maximum charge. But what we're finding here, now you may be more efficient in the States, your financial services companies may be better than ours, but what we seem to be finding is that even at a 1.5% annual charge, the companies are not able to make money on small contributions. So it's only the sort of relatively well-off who can afford to save quite a lot who are getting well-served in the marketplace. And I think my concern in the UK particularly is that unless you're in the top 10 or 20% of the income distribution, privatization has not been delivering good value.
Jonathan Gruber, I wonder if I can just ask you, is there anything, are there lessons from the British experience that we should be paying particular attention to in this country?
Yes, Joe, I think there are. I first want to come back to your very good question, which is, gee, 1% a year, why can that matter? Remember that administrative costs are on the entire amount in your account. You're only earning 3 or 4% a year. So if you lose 1% a year in administrative costs, that's a third to a quarter of what you would earn that year. So even 1% is very, very large. So, for example, if administrative costs are 1% a year, by the time you retire, you have about a third less than you would have with no administrative costs. So even a small-sounding number matters a lot. I think the lesson is that basically wherever we've seen privatization around the world, in the UK and Chile, these administrative costs have been high. There's lots of people who say, well, that won't happen in the US. But in some sense, there's no evidence to the contrary yet. There's no evidence to support that yet. We do have a well-functioning capital market, and we'd like to believe the administrative costs would be low, but these are going to be a lot of very small accounts for most workers. And they're expensive to administer, and even a small administrative cost can end up eating up a lot of the savings. So you have to ask yourself, is the efficiency you get from private investment so large as to overcompensate the extra administrative costs, where Social Security is about 0.03% in terms of administrative costs?
Right. Well, let's take a call now from Jennifer in Medford, Oregon. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was in my 20s in England in the 1980s when financial institutions were pushing the private pension plans very hard. And from what Caroline said, you can hear that they sound very compelling, and I was persuaded as a young professional to buy one. It transpired that I was really missold a plan. I was sold a plan that was not in my best interest. And I was one of millions that happened to. And fortunately, because I was one of millions, there was pressure. I think because financial institutions there don't pull the strings the way they do here, the government did step in, and all cases were reviewed, including my own. Financial institutions had to set up departments to audit each of their cases. I was awarded about $20,000 for my losses. It was ascribed that I'd lost about $20,000 in the process. But that sounds great, but the truth is I basically have very little of a pension now, because between finding out I'd been missold and having it settled, I put nothing more in. And it has been a real tragedy for, I think, millions of people.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for that call. Roz Altman, is that a common story that you hear?
And absolutely.
Has this
absolutely
privatization plan then cost the government actually more than it would have ultimately saved them, or would have?
Well, the compensation was paid by the financial services companies,
right,
not by the government.
Okay.
So to that extent, it wasn't the government that picked up that bill. However, the knock-on effects on confidence in pensions generally have been so dramatic. And, you know, we've had a series of scandals, one after another, to do with pensions and, you know, to do with the privatization of pensions, which has ended up meaning that in a country which used to have a brilliant retirement savings culture, pension provision is now crumbling. You know, there is a dramatic problem at the moment in the UK with confidence in pensions. And if you ask most young people, they will now tell you they do not want to put money into pension because they don't trust it. They've heard about the mis-selling. They've heard about the problems that surround private pensions, the fall in the stock market, and the poor returns that have been earned. I mean, even with tax incentives that we give people here, you know, there's quite powerful tax relief on pension contributions. Most private pensions seem to have only broken even over the last 10 years or so. Now, that's not what people would have been expecting.
No.
You could argue that U.S. companies will do better, but the evidence in the U.K., you know, suggests that you need to think very carefully about how you structure the charges and what kind of products people are persuaded to invest in, and that they really do understand what they're doing.
Well, thank you for that cautionary tale. Roz Altman is a governor at the London School of Economics. She advises the British Parliament on pension issues. Ms. Altman joined us from her home in London. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Next, we turn to José Piñera, a labor and social security minister under General Augusto Pinochet. He was a chief architect of Chile's current social security system, which offers private accounts. He joins us by phone from his office in Santiago. Mr. Piñera.
Hello, Joe.
Hello. Welcome to the program. This is Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
So, before you introduced private accounts in 1980, Chile also had a traditional pay-as-you-go system. Why did the old system have to change?
Two reasons. First, demographics. As we all know, life expectancy is increasing. People are having less babies. Therefore, there are each time less workers to finance the benefits of every pensioner. Something that von Bismarck, the creator of pay-as-you-go in Prussia in the 19th century, never dreamed of, that demographic will kill his system. And the second one is political manipulation. The fact that when you have a government monopoly that depends on politicians' will, you have a lot of political discussion about that. That is precisely why are you discussing this in the U.S. instead of talking about, homeland security, crime, education, whatever. You are discussing a pension system at the nation level. Why? Because it depends on politicians, on political forces. So what we set up in Chile was a system that does not depend on politics. It depends on saving for old age.
Right. And so how did the private accounts work? How did those work in Chile?
Oh, extremely simple. As Secretary of Labor and Social Security, I went on TV for a year, and I told workers, look, you have this government system, a monopoly, but if you like it, you can keep it forever, and you have the political risk. I offer you an alternative as a free choice, voluntarily personal retirement accounts. Now, since probably you don't have you money to save extra at the end of the month, as most middle and low-income workers do not, I offer you the possibility of opting out with your FICA tax from the government system and invest that money in a personal retirement account. And that money will grow during your whole working life, let's say 40, 45 years, at compound rate of return that is extremely fast, geometrically, as it's known. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when you reach 65, you don't look at the budget surplus or deficit. You don't look at the Congress. You don't look at who is in power. You simply look at your personal retirement account, and you will have hundreds of thousands of dollars there that will be your property, your ownership. Nobody can touch it like a checking account. And then you convert that capital into an annuity for life for you and your family.
Mr. Piñera,
it's extremely clear, extremely simple, and you can choose it. So if you don't like the risk, You don't like the fact that there is a fee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you will choose it.
Yep.
But why don't you give the other people the right to choose?
We have to take a short break right now. We'll finish up our discussion about Social Security in other parts of the world and a look at smoking bans. Just this week, Cuba enforces a ban on smoking in public places. So what's the effect on public health? And what's your opinion of smoking in public places? I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For now, we're finishing up a discussion about privatized social security systems in England and Chile. With us are MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who's written a book on social security, and Jose Piñera, the architect of Chile's privatized system. And Mr. Piñera, we were just talking with you, and you were saying that people have this choice, and they can put their money where they think is wise, and they don't have to worry about the government or the deficit or surpluses or anything. But what if they make a bad choice? Is it just their hard luck and they're out in the cold?
Well, in a free society, people make bad choices, or otherwise you will eliminate voting or democracy. Don't you think people also make bad choices in political life?
Absolutely. I'm just wondering if the streets of Santiago are littered with people who made bad decisions about how to, you know, put their pension money, and now they're, you know, having to trust in charity.
No, on the contrary, people are not fooled, my friend.
Uh-huh.
95% of Chileans chose the personal retirement account, 95%.
Wow.
And the choices are, of course, conservative choices. Everyone knows that you cannot put the money in an internet stock. You have to put it in index stocks, index bonds, a mixed portfolio that is very safe, very conservative, that has given a rate of return of 10% above inflation for 24 years. On average, 10% above inflation for 24 years. No worker has ever lost a peso in this system. Of course, there is a supervisory authority. Of course, there are rules for diversification. Of course, it is a very conservative execution of a very revolutionary approach to Social Security. And finally, there is a safety net financed by the government. So if in the case of someone who has been unemployed during many years or something like that, of course we are a compassionate society and we have a safety net. So you have the safety net, and above that you have these personal retirement accounts safely invested, and they are giving a 10% rate of return.
Well, Jose Piñera, thank you very much for describing that system to us today.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Jose Piñera is a chief architect of Chile's social security system, as well as co-chairman of the Cato Institute's project on social security choice. He joined us by phone from his office in Santiago, Chile. And now Jonathan Gruber, who's been waiting patiently in Massachusetts to have a word. What did you make of Mr. Piñera's presentation?
Well, I think that was a very compelling case for what was a very radical revolutionary approach at the time, and Chile deserves credit for doing that. I think there's a couple things you have to remember. First of all, Chile had a dictator. What that meant was they were able to run a surplus that was 5% of their gross domestic product for well over 10 years, probably 20 years. The U.S. struggles to get to balance budget, not to mention running a 5% surplus. As a result, they were able to finance those transition costs, which are this difficult thing that, once again, if I take my money and invest it now, who pays for today's grandparents? They did it, as it said in Wall Street Journal the other day, that was done at bayonet point. Basically, taxpayers had to finance today's grandparents because the dictator told them they had to. We don't do that in the U.S., so that's one difficult issue. The second difficult issue is Chile faced a much less functional government system than we face. In developing countries in general, and most privatization has happened in developing countries, the government's social security system does not work well. It's very corrupt. It's very inefficient. That's not true in the U.S. We have a very well-functioning, low-cost government system. So in some sense, the cost of staying with the government approach is much lower in the U.S. than it was in Chile. And then finally, the final issue is this issue about freedom of choice. Investing for your retirement is an incredibly complicated decision. I'm not sure I've gotten it right. Most Americans don't get it right. And that is really a very complicated decision with which to trust people when, once again, the whole reason we have the system is we don't trust them to save for their retirement in the first place. To then empower them to decide whether to invest in stock A or stock B, I think it's a very risky proposition.
All right. Well, we have time for one final quick call, so let's go to Frank in St. Louis, Missouri. Frank, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I don't know. I haven't heard the whole show, so I don't know if you've talked about this, but Chile's a small economy, and if they're investing, you know, so much into the markets, that's not like the United States doing it. It would be like the, you know, 800-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
And so we'd have all this money chasing stocks and driving up the price of the stocks when the actual value of the stock remains the same. I mean, you can dump, you know, trillions of dollars in the stock market, but the companies are still there making the same amount of money, and they'll pay the same dividends. And so we'd just be looking at a bubble, it seems to me. Did Chile do this? Did they invest in their national market, or were they investing in, you know, U.S. Treasuries and, you know, AT&T or, you know, U.S. Steel or whatever?
Well, Frank, thanks for that call. Jonathan Gruber, is that how it went? Did they invest all at once?
Well, that's another advantage of the Chilean approach, was they had a very underdeveloped capital market. And essentially, privatization had the nice feature of jump-starting the development of that capital market. You took a very small national stock market. The assets were mostly invested nationally in Chilean stocks, and it really grew the market, and that's part of why they had those extraordinary returns. That's obviously not the case in the U.S. Obviously, we have a very well-developed market. The issue is if you suddenly started putting a lot of money in, what would happen? And really, it's not clear, because on the one hand, you're right, you're going to throw a lot of money in. That'll be chasing stock prices up. On the other hand, part of the reason stocks have been such a good return historically is because fundamentally people have been afraid to invest in them. When people are afraid to invest in them, those who are brave enough have earned extraordinary returns. Once everybody's in the market, you can't have extraordinary returns anymore. So it's not really clear which way it goes. It's not clear whether stock returns will go up or down in a privatized system.
Well, it's a complicated picture, but thank you for shedding some light on it today for us.
You're welcome, Joe.
Jonathan Gruber is a professor of economics at MIT and co-editor of the book Social Security Programs and Retirement Around the World. He came to us from a studio at Berkland Productions in Watertown, Massachusetts.